Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
I suppose the way I've worked out in my brain, I'm like, if it's on a story and it's not a work-related thing, do whatever you want, sweetheart. Chuck a filter on it. Do whatever you want. But if you're trying to show a makeup look or a makeup technique, then in that space, in my opinion, a filter is unforgivable.
Hello and welcome back to Beautiful Lives, the podcast in which I, Madeleine Spencer, am joined by guests to share some of the challenges they faced and triumphs they've enjoyed during their life, as well as touching on the relationship between their inner and outer self and where beauty memories and rituals have had an impact. Today, I'm joined by the makeup artist Hannah Martin. She's far too discreet to divulge her client list, but let's just say there are a fair few royals on there, and she's created some of the most dreamy, them but better, so to speak, makeup looks you'll be well acquainted with. This episode is a bit about how Hannah embarked on that journey. I especially loved hearing about how a counsellor changed the trajectory of her life and found her tips towards the end really handy, but it's also a lot about her life and how Hannah navigated the grief of losing her mum and about the secret to her long marriage to Simon. I was very moved by a lot of what Hannah said, particularly during those sections. This episode is brought to you by Temple Spa, one of my favourite luxury British skincare brands. Using only the finest ingredients, Temple Spa are all about creating exceptional results-driven skincare and experiences that make a real difference to your skin and soul health. Please do keep listening to hear more about my recent immersive online Spa2Go experience and how you can get involved a little later on the show. Here's Hannah. Hi, Hannah Martin. Thank you so much for making time to come on.
Oh, thanks for having me. I'm sorry it's taken us so long to finally have this moment.
You are on my list right from when I started recording these podcasts. Tell me then about you, your childhood. Where did this makeup thing have its roots? When did you first have a moment of noticing the way people look?
So what's interesting, and I'm sad I'm sitting on this side of the room, because I was literally just talking about this very same thing and showing some props. But my mum had a really kind of sweet dressing table. She bought it for her 21st birthday, and she'd sit at that dressing table every morning and do her makeup. And she had, it was kind of one half of like a clip mirror, and it's kind of a pink and white swirly thing. Two little mirrors on it, one's magnifying, one's not. And she'd slot it, it was broken, so she'd slot it between her fingers and then start her makeup routine. And the dressing table's in my garage. I have the mirror literally behind me at my makeup station. And I was absolutely transfixed. And I remember she had like a squeezy, I want to say it was Vichy, but a squeezy tinted moisturiser that was significantly warmer than her skin tone. She had like an olive skin with freckles. But I remember being, you know, if ever I saw her without her makeup, I was surprised how pale she was naturally. And she'd kind of dot this Vichy tinted moisturiser all over and blend it in. And then she was very fastidious about her eyebrows and also her mascara. And pinned to my makeup mirror in front of me, I have, and don't try this at home, kids, I have one of her nappy pins, because again, it was just so synonymous with me, like transfixed by her doing her makeup, because she used this nappy pin to, don't try this at home, to unpick her mascara. So she'd curl her lashes so they were, you know, totally vertical. Yeah. Then she'd really fastidiously apply her mascara, and then she would go through with a nappy pin to make sure they were all perfectly even and fanned. And it was an art, and I loved it. And they are some of my fondest memories of just kind of sitting and watching that process happen. And I think, like most children, I thought my mum was the most beautiful woman in the world. And I loved watching makeup transform her.
Aside from the moisturiser that you said was slightly tinted moisturiser, slightly the wrong colour, Was she good at makeup that you remember?
She always looked great, but I remember so clearly when everything switched for the better. Now, she loved her. I was showing her Mary Quant, beautiful pink Mary Quant blush. She was a fan of a green Dior eyeliner. And, you know, there was a kind of phase in the early 90s where she wore lipstick that was far too dark. It was a bit severe in the nicest way possible. It was still very beautiful, but it was just a bit severe. And yeah. Then, you know, we lived in the Cotswolds. It wasn't a particular, like, fashion mecca or anything, but she did book to have a makeover at the Clinique counter in the Cirencester branch of House of Fraser. I think it was a Rackham's. And she came back from that session like a completely different woman. They had toned down the colour palette. She now had, I remember, mocha pink blusher, which was discontinued now, but a beautiful, quite neutral pink. I'd say kind of Bobbi Brown Cosmetics sand pink. Pink sand is kind of the closest thing. And a beautiful, very soft, again, muted brown eyeshadow, creamy, neutral lipstick. And she it's like she blossomed into her most beautiful self and looked so much younger with this kind of softer, lighter palette. And I remember being literally blown away. I was like, I already thought she was the most beautiful woman in the world, and now she was like breathtaking because she'd been, you know, recommended makeup that just suited her colouring so well. And yeah, that was a real turning point actually for her.
Who else was in your household then? Did you have siblings?
I had an elder sister, Katie, and my dad.
And was she quite makeup-y, Katie?
No, I wouldn't say she was. I mean, we were very different children in that she was very, very clever and a real academic. And also really quite creative. You know, she excelled at textiles at school and was more of the kind of, you know, patchwork dungarees with a bit of purple hair dye vibe, listening to Oasis or whatever. Whereas I was kind of tomboy, sporty, childlike in every sense. I was tiny until I was about 14. So although we were less than 2 years apart, you know, she's still kind of 5 foot. She's 5 foot six or 5 foot eight. Yeah. She's much taller than me, but there were a good couple of years where I was like this pocket person, and she was really tall. So we could have been 10 years apart in age. It was really funny. So we were really different. So I think, you know, I took my makeup inspo definitely from mummy.
And when did you start wearing makeup? What do you remember from those early days?
So I remember loving it. But I remember, you know, not necessarily not wanting to wear it, but just there were, you know, from the kind of absolute obsession with my Tinkerbell makeup set that I got one Christmas at the kind of age 4, which comprised of a bronze blush colour and like that peel off nail varnish stuff that came off in the bath. There was a massive chasm where just makeup didn't really feature. And then suddenly I just, you know, I grew obsessed with Natural Collection clear lip gloss and clear mascara. Like, we weren't allowed to wear makeup at school, but we'd all kind of sneak on a bit of clear mascara. And to be fair, you couldn't see really any benefit, but it was just that knowing that you're wearing your clear mascara. And then as that kind of fascination grew, I started asking for Boots vouchers. So, you know, people say, oh, what do you want for your birthday? You know, and it went from kind of pogo sticks to Boots vouchers. And I'd go to Boots and, you know, I fell in love with a Rimmel eyeshadow that was kind of a twinsy eyeshadow. One was like a shimmery champagne, the other was a brown. And I did kind of the classic champagne lid with the brown through the crease. And then I bought up loads of kind of neutrals from Natural Collection, kind of camel tones, browns, brick kind of eyeshadow colours. And I'd absolutely love kind of playing with him. But I remember very clearly going to my youth group one evening, and I think I'd asked my sister for help actually, and I must have been about 14, and Sarah, one of the youth group leaders, was like, oh, I've never seen you in like proper makeup. Oh, you look lovely. And maybe I'm overthinking this, but I don't really remember having received compliments for my appearance before. Do you know what I mean? Because I was very much like straight up and down, tomboy, sporty, you know, very childlike in features. And I was delighted to finally feel like I'd had a bit of an acknowledgement of my very young, but still kind of womanhood. Yeah. You know, friends of mine were like, you know, curves and, you know, and had been for years. And I physically wasn't there for it. I was, you know, quite a late bloomer in that sense.
Mm, so it kind of handed you that baton of like, you're a woman and you can be seen almost at quite a young age.
Yeah, honestly, when I was 14, people would think I was like 9, 10 because I was so tiny. And it just felt, I loved being almost just being recognised for a minute as not being a 10-year-old.
But then a year later, you met your now husband, Simon, at 15. I find that staggering.
And it's funny because I joke all the time because, you know, had we met any sooner, and my fear is that he maybe wouldn't have been able to get past the like sporty tomboy. And I'm like, I can just see this scenario where we would have been the very best of friends and I'd have been like madly in love with him, but it would have been horribly unrequited. So I'm eternally thankful that I had a year to grow into womanhood a little bit. I mean, I was still a bit sporty and scrawny really until I went to uni, but yes, I'm glad we hadn't met any earlier.
And you've been married now for how many years?
We just had our 15th wedding anniversary.
Wow. Okay, so what do you reckon the secret to having that long relationship and still being really into each other is?
I wish I knew. I think, you know, we very much had a very strong basis of friendship from the get-go. Like, we were the very best of friends. That is still the case. I mean, it sounds cheesy, doesn't it? But I suppose one of the keys is that we chose to commit, or like we chose to love each other or commit to love each other for life. So very much I feel like that means that when the going gets tough, you kind of go through it rather than leave it or run away from it. Does that make sense? But we did probably, so it was before I got pregnant with Beau. So, and she's nearly four. So quite a few years ago, we actually did something called the marriage course. And it was absolutely brilliant. And it was actually at the time, it was really needed. And I want to say it was an 8-week course. It was on a Monday night. We met in central London, went to this course. They forced you to sit at a small table together and you kind of had people speaking from the front, Nikki and Cilla Lee, and then you had a kind of workbook. And, you know, there'd be times, you know, each week was a kind of a different topic and they made you confront things and talk. And actually one of the most eye-opening sessions was a listening session. And I was like, I'm a great listener. You're the one who doesn't listen to me, blah, blah, blah. And they made us do this exercise where you had to listen to your partner for 20 minutes and not say a word. And it was the hardest thing because I realised, or, you know, it shone a light on the fact that I often will jump in when Simon's trying to speak. And I think I know where he's going, so I jump in. And I often jump in because I've got such a poor short-term memory that I panic if I don't say what I'm thinking right then that I'll forget it or whatever. But actually, I realised in that moment that I wasn't practising effective listening. And, you know, you want to be heard. Of course you want to be heard, especially by your partner. So, yeah. That was a real eye-opener. And we still use a lot of the stuff we learned to that marriage course, like now, in our marriage.
When you were with Simon, right in the early days, going back, you went to uni and you studied nursing.
Yeah.
Did you want to be a nurse at that point then?
Well, did I want to be a nurse at that point? I think I did. Kind of when school finished, it all got a bit confusing. So, you know, Si wanted to go to Cambridge, but he didn't get in. I wanted to go to theatre school. I didn't get in. I had like an emergency gap year. He had a bit of an emergency gap year. We then had this plan. We're like, right, well, I'll go to Oxford Brookes and do nursing. You'll go to Oxford and we'll have this lovely kind of joint experience and it'll be great. He then overslept and missed his Oxford interview, and which he kept a secret until our wedding day when his best man spilt the beans. And I've never seen his dad, Rob, look more mortified in all his life. He looked down the table at me and said, Hannah, is this true? I was like, yeah, I'm really sorry. So he ended up going to Durham. So, you know, about as far away as he could get really within, you know, England. And I think initially I thought, do you know what? Nursing's a good idea. So his mum was a nurse. I was like, I do love people. It's not acting, but I've failed miserably at the one thing I thought I probably could do. So why not? Let's try something completely different.
Also, what appealed to you about acting then? Were you someone who was always quite dramatic when you were younger and into the arts?
Oh, yeah, I loved it. I loved theatre. I loved going to the theatre, you know. My grandfather used to take my sister and I when we were really young. My parents loved theatre too. So, you know, theatre was a big part of growing up and I loved performing. You know, it started with kind of dance shows when I was really little. And then, I love drama and Amdram. And as someone who just wasn't academic, you know, I was really sporty, but I wasn't sporty enough to, you know, excel in sports like professionally or whatever. I was really musical, but I wasn't musical enough, you know, to join an orchestra for a living or whatever. But acting I was kind of okay at, and you know, I still have the letter of recommendation from my drama teacher recommending me for theatre school because, you know, it was such a dream.
How did you go from nursing at uni into working in makeup?
So I actually had a bit of counselling at uni because I was utterly miserable. And I wish I knew her name, you know. I saw her once in Fenwick Bond Street. And I said to her, I was like, oh, I know you. I recognise you. And she was like, And then it finally clicked. And she was like, yeah, it's not data protection, is it? But whatever the rules are, she was like, yeah. I can't tell you, but if you remember me, that's totally fine. But I remember sobbing in her office, just saying, you know, I'm so miserable. I don't think I want to be a nurse for the rest of my life, but I've already failed at one thing. I can't fail at something else. And she said to me, like, if you could do anything, what would you want to do? And I had a school friend called Rowena Pinches who was at LCF doing theatrical makeup, and I was like, I'd love to go to London College of Fashion and study theatrical makeup. And she said, well, why don't you? And I was so surprised that she considered it an option, because I just didn't think I had the choice, or I didn't think I could change path again. And I think the fear of failing was huge. I was like, well, what if I try that and I fail at that as well? I suppose I had a bit of a midlife crisis when I was very young, put it that way. And I, you know, I just thought, well, maybe I can. And I did a bit of assisting. I remember sharing a bit of my like yearning to get into makeup at the benefit counter in Oxford. Now, at the time in the Debenhams, you know, they're... It was all kind of your traditional makeup houses. So there was Chanel and there was Dior, there was Clinique, Clarins, Aveda, and then there was Benefit, and Benefit seemed to be where everything was happening. Yes. And I remember sharing this with one of the girls at the counter. It was something like I was telling her this on the Thursday and then I worked a shift on the Sunday. Like, it was a very kind of rapid... Well, don't just talk about this. Why didn't you come and work with us and see how you get on? And I did that alongside my last year of uni, like, and then the year between finishing my degree and Simon finishing his degree, I worked there full time. And that was kind of the start.
And how did you find people to assist? Did that come through that as well?
No. So it first came through, the first assisting job I got was assisting a makeup artist who'd done my makeup on. I used to do a little bit of, for the local hair salon in Oxford, I used to do a bit of hair modelling.
Okay.
So, you know, pictures in the window, and I assisted her, which was great fun. I think one of the biggest worries I had was telling my parents that I wanted to try again something different. And so I finished my degree. I didn't leave. So I finished, I completed the hours. I didn't do a dissertation. I didn't do the management module. So it was downgraded to an advanced diploma. But like, I didn't even go to my graduation or anything. I was so... Okay. I was so done.
What did your parents do?
My mum had lots of different jobs. My dad's a solicitor. My mum had lots of different jobs. She was a dairy maid at Loseley Farm for some time. And then she worked for, it used to be called the Spastic Society. It's not, is it called Scope now?
I'm not sure.
We can look into that. But I remember telling all my friends that she once got to demonstrate a new wheelchair on Blue Peter, and I thought that was the coolest claim to fame ever. And then in later years, she ran a bed and breakfast at our home, which was lovely. But it was funny. I knew they thought it was really risky, but I remember receiving a message from one of her friends after she died, Carol Mannheim, who I actually never really knew that well because I was never really at home when they were friends or whatever. My sister knew her very well. And she said, and I don't know if I loved the message or not, but she just said, you know, your mum would be really proud. We were all so worried when you said you wanted to try makeup, but well done. You've shown what kind of hard work and perseverance can do. And yeah, I remember feeling a bit like mixed about the message in itself. I wonder if the point was I actually, you know, when I think back, I actually had nothing but encouragement from my mum. I think confirming that she'd voiced to her friends that she was really, really worried made me feel a bit bad, I suppose.
And you were 28 when your mum passed away. Was it sudden? Were you expecting it?
We knew it was coming. So she had cancer. And from diagnosis, they gave her a year to live. So it was we knew it'd be quite quick. But then we went for dinner. I don't think the restaurant exists anymore, called Allium in Fairford, to celebrate her sell by date, as she called it, because she lived, you know, past her original prognosis. But I think it was 15 months, 16 months.
Was there anything that you lent on, or anyone you lent on? Anything that really helped you, I suppose, in handling grief?
I actually had some therapy probably 18 months after she died, maybe a bit longer. Obviously, I lent on my husband a lot. At the time, you know, we lived in London. We didn't have any family in London. His parents actually were living in Kenya. So we didn't really have like a particularly strong support network. Mm-hmm. Oh, yes, we had lots of friends. However, I'd been in a role for a couple of years in the run-up to my mum's death that meant I travelled a lot. And because I travelled a lot, actually, we were quite disconnected from our London friendship circle because I wasn't present. And when, you know, if I was home for the weekend, then we'd go to Gloucestershire to be with my mum. So, and we were young, do you know what I mean? I feel like when, you know, your friend is grieving intensely in their 20s, you don't necessarily have the life experience to know how best to help. Mm-hmm. And I just remember being inundated with, if there's anything I can, let me know if there's anything I can do to help. And actually, I didn't have the mental capacity to think of a menial task that I could ask someone to do to help them feel better that they were helping me. Do you know what I mean? Because actually, it's quite a hollow gesture because you're putting all the emphasis on the grieving person to think of something you could do. And I'll always remember, and this is thanks to Bobby Brown again, a talk that I was privy to at one of our conferences in New York from, oh, it's going to bother me, her name's escaped me, but it will come. She wrote a book called Breaking Dawn. It'll come to me. Anyway, she's, her job is now as a motivational speaker, and she, her words were, don't let what you can't do get in the way of what you can do. And that's something I've carried with me from the moment I heard that, because, you know, my friends couldn't help my pain. They couldn't bring my mum back, but they could drop food. They could pop in and just do the washing up surreptitiously. They could pop around to just chat. They could just be. Do you know what I mean? So you can't necessarily fix the situation, but you can just without think, without asking, do little things that make life that little bit easier.
Did you go straight back to work?
I had 5 weeks off because I also, I actually had a miscarriage at my mum's funeral. So, I started miscarrying, but then I had
Had you had your first child before?
No. Okay, so this was our first round of IVF. So I actually, we missed my mum's wake because we went to the church, we went to the internment and literally left the graveside to go to hospital and where they confirmed, yeah, that I'd lost the baby. So I was processing like that at the same time.
You were working at Bobbi Brown at the time, is that right? So how long had you been there for at that stage?
At that stage, so if that's 2011, since 2006. Mm-hmm. Okay. So a good 5 years. And I'd been in my, like, you know, that pro artist role for probably 3 years at that point.
Right, so you knew lots of people and there was a lot of, like, understanding of your life and what you were going through at the time as well.
Yeah, I mean, I look back and I wish I'd been slightly firmer, let's say, with what I needed at the time. And, you know, something that haunts me, and I will get over it, but something that haunts me was that I had said really clearly, my mum is dying. Please, can I not work weekends? Because I need to spend whatever time I can in Gloucestershire with her. And the weekend before she died, I was working in Cardiff. And, you know, I did get back to Gloucestershire, but not till really late on the Saturday night. And then I had Sunday with her, but then I had to leave to get back to London ready for work on Monday. And then when I got the call from my sister to say, like, babe, the nurses reckon it's imminent, you need to come home, I was almost at Edinburgh. So again, I lost another day because I had to get to Edinburgh to turn around and then get back from Edinburgh to London and then home from London back to Gloucestershire. So, you know, I just, it's silly because it's like, it still like makes my throat tighten when I talk about it now, you know. And of course my work were very accommodating and they were good, but I wish my request to be more local had been really heard so that those precious hours, you know, we're talking hours, those precious hours that I could have snatched with her, I hadn't lost to work and travel, you know.
Oh, that sounds awful. And how many rounds of IVF had you done as well at that point?
So we did three all in all. And I was one of those fortunate people that actually I got pregnant every time. I just kept losing them. So, and actually our daughter, Bo, was a miracle conception. She was a natural conception, which, you know, she's the biggest surprise of my life and the biggest gift of my life. The only thing that's frustrating is I am now that statistic where people so unhelpfully say, stop trying, don't think about it, and it will just happen. And I suppose that's exactly what we did do. My husband was training for an Ironman triathlon. We'd parked IVF to have some time off because, you know, we had three miscarriages. It was all just a bit stressful. And then I got pregnant naturally.
As promised, I thought I'd use a little break in this episode to tell you a bit more about my Spa to Go class experience with Temple Spa. After joining a class a few weeks ago, I decided to host my own, so I asked a few of my oldest friends to join me for a pamper across Zoom, with a Spa2Go lifestyle consultant. Learning about the results-driven ingredients in our skincare as well as trying out the products was such a treat, and we unanimously fell for the In the Beginning cleanser and the Repose night cream, both of which are fixtures on my skincare shelf, by the way. It was such a lovely reason to all come together, and I'd very much recommend. So if you want to host a class, you can band together with some friends and have a virtual skincare session, or grab your nearest and dearest and bring the spa to your home. Temple Spa will send you the little box of products beforehand, so you're good to go. And if you fancy, you could also become a Spa2Go lifestyle consultant and lead the classes. I'll pop all the links and info in my show notes. Thank you for powering today's episode, Temple Spa, and let's go back to Hannah Martin now. Let's just rewind a little bit in your career and then I'll come to the present day. I would say that you are very well known for doing healthy glow, which is why you so naturally segued into, or were always, but segued really well into doing wedding makeup, because, you know, you make people look how they want to look, like that sort of Jennifer Aniston-y glow.
Oh, what a great reference. Yeah.
Was that something that you just sort of gravitated towards?
Yeah, I think it's just my favourite kind of look.
Yeah.
I love fairly simple, fairly straightforward, glowing skin, mm-hmm. and usually like a soft, smoky eye. I think I'm just inspired by like classic beauty pictures. If I think of the stuff that I was tearing out of magazines, it was always just the classic beauty. I'm looking at my books here and I've got Andrew Gallimore's book. I have so much appreciation for, you know, real creative makeup, and I, you know, it's such an incredible art form, but I'm fully aware that that's not where my strengths lie, because that's not where my passion is. My passion is actually just helping women feel beautiful. I love it. There's nothing more addictive, or kind of, for me, what's the happy drug? Is it dopamine?
I think it is dopamine.
For me, it's that feeling when someone looks in the mirror and you see their whole spirit lift, their shoulders drop, and they you know, they start zhuzhing their hair and flicking and pouting, and you know they walk away with a hop and a skip. And you know, people genuinely do that when they feel incredible, and that's probably just, yeah, that's my favorite thing about the power of makeup.
So you have done a lot of famous brides. The one that I can mention is Eugenie, Royal Brides too, which is a makeup, by the way. When I saw that, I didn't know you'd done it until about, I don't know, 20 minutes into the wedding, when I was on Instagram, people going, oh, it's Hannah Martin. But I saw her walking down the aisle, and I think I put on my Instagram, this is the best I've ever seen her look. And the difference between the sort of glowing, you know, proper, I want to say Hannah Martin signature makeup and her usual makeup was really pronounced. I wanted to ask you a little bit about that, and about doing other really brides where it's on like a big stage and you know it's going to be watched on television, and it's a big deal. How that feels for you. And also something I asked Mary Greenwell, who has done, you know, very prominent people. In that room, when you're doing the makeup, and there are people around that you know from, you know, the press, whatever it is, but people around that you know, and it's a big deal. Do you feel the sense of that as you're doing it, or do you go into an automatic mode?
I think there's, you know, there has been, ahead of big events, you know, a certain amount of anxiety and stress, because you know it's a makeup look that's, you know, it's going to be critiqued. I think sometimes the general public are kinder than peers, because for some reason, I think peers quite like to pick apart each other's work. I don't know what purpose it serves. And actually, I was talking to a friend about this recently, where I was like, actually, as a makeup artist, I very much try to not judge a makeup look, because you never know the circumstances behind it. So you don't know if the client insisted on said shade of foundation. You don't know if the makeup artist had 5 minutes whilst hair and nails were working at the same time. You just never know. So don't judge. But yeah, no. So I think I've always gone into those kind of slightly bigger jobs nervous. And, you know, often, yeah, some circumstances actually haven't been that... that easy. if I think back to my darling Eugenie's wedding, actually, just the way life worked, we didn't get to Windsor till fairly late. The hotel was incredibly busy with guests. We were put in a room that didn't have any beds for the children. Beau Diana, it's the only time she's ever been physically sick. She started throwing up. She fell asleep. So Simon like lay at the end of her cot bed. I shared a bed with Bear, who kicked me all night. And I was like, I can't believe I've got such a big job in the morning and I'm not sleeping. This isn't happening. But thankfully, with the bigger weddings I've done, there's always been prep time. And we've managed to create like an atmosphere of calm whilst we're doing makeup so that there's, you know, time to focus, time to get it right. As you know, when you're working with a bride or any client, yes, it's so important that you get the look right and you collaboratively agree what's going to work best. But actually, so much of our job is being a friend, being a confidant, and being a listening ear and kind of like a stabilizer, you know, in an otherwise fairly kind of stressful situation.
Do you have a way that you engender this calm thing?
It's not kind of aromatherapy or candles. I do love little LED mask moment. I have mine from the light salon, which is just, you know, 10 minutes of calm. Yes, it's skin prep, but it's also just a moment to kind of decompress. But I'm afraid I'm a stickler for a bit of a schedule. And I think brides think it's really annoying, but it's always the weddings where, you know, they profess to be relaxed and chilled and no need for a schedule, like we'll just go with the flow, that actually become really stressful. And you're right, like, you know, yes, they might think it's really fun to have all the champagne going and the loud music and it's party vibes, but actually when you're trying to do your very best work, all those kind of distractions are just not helpful. So I too often say to my brides, you know, if possible, it'd be lovely if we could have, you know, a calm moment together. I remember one of my brides, the lovely Alice Edwards, you know, she actually stipulated that, and we took ourselves off and got ready elsewhere, and it was perfect. And that was quite a few years ago now, but I remember thinking, right, I'm going to try and do this with my brides going forward. But it's not always possible, you know. Sometimes if you're in a venue and there is only one room, and you know, you're like, okay, you've got 8 bridesmaids, the bride, the dogs, 3 hairdressers, you know, wedding planner, it's all going on, and you just have to crack on. What I do is I endeavour to always set my kit out in the same way, the same pattern. And that it doesn't, I don't always get the time or the space, but I try to. And it's something I learned at Bobbi Brown Cosmetics. And that's just so that you kind of always know roughly where you're reaching for the product that you need. And that really helps. It's always the jobs where I don't have time to set up properly that I get most flustered, because there's nothing like being in a rush, feeling a bit panicked, to make you blind.
I'm going to ask you some sort of fairly specific questions surrounding this topic, so more product based. So the first thing is, if I would say to you 5 makeup products to get your signature look, if someone wanted to go off and do it, what would be your 5?
Ooh, an excellent moisturiser. A tinted moisturiser, a concealer, a cream blush, and a mascara. So that's keeping it very, very minimal. But I think with those 5, you've got the basis of a bit of a glow. How you prep the skin is so important. And maybe I just need to do a video about it, because I feel like I'm saying this on repeat to people who are like, Hannah, I bought X and X foundation, but my skin still doesn't look glowy. I'm like, okay, let's unpick it. What's your skin type? What are you wearing underneath? You know, how are you treating your skin? And I think often there's a misconception that the foundation is the product that's going to make your skin look its best, when actually 98% of the time, it's actually the prep beforehand.
100%. Yeah. So with those products then, do you think that spans any age?
Actually, yeah. If you're young and maybe you've got problematic skin, it's okay. You've got a sheer base and you've got concealer that you can top up to conceal any blemishes. If you are more mature, it's always much more modern and youthful appearing to have a bit of a glow to your skin.
I asked people online what they'd like to ask you. A lot of people said, I'm mature. Can I still do makeup? Can I still do X? Can I still do Y? So what would you say the answer to that is?
Absolutely, yes. Yes. It might be that your skin needs more moisture than it did before. It might be that you want to opt for a lighter foundation that you've before. It might be that, like my mum, it's time to investigate a slightly more muted hues. Now, I don't mean muted hues so you disappear and you're not noticeable. That's not what I mean. But I mean, there is a time as your skin tone changes, as your hair colour maybe changes, where, you know, my mum's emerald green eyeliner stopped working. It was too harsh, and it might be that opting for a softer route is more flattering.
Bringing a face to life, if you just look grey and pale and pasty and bad, not that pale always looks tired, actually, but if you're looking tired and you've got that feeling that you just want to take your energy in your face up, what's the easiest way to do that?
Again, moisturiser. Like, I can't tell you the mornings where I'd had no sleep after a night out with the kids and just feeling deathly, but then putting on a really rich balm and suddenly having this glow to the skin is like, oh, actually, I don't look half as bad as I thought I did. But I'm a massive believer in colour. So whether that's, and pink, it works across every skin tone, a bit of pink on the cheek, a bit of pink on the lip, and it just revitalizes you. And I think it's because it is emulating your skin at its healthiest. You know, if you've been for a brisk walk or whatever and a bit of blood's rushed to the surface, if you can put a bit of color back into, you know, a slightly sallow or just kind of worn, tired face, it can be very uplifting.
And do you feel like there's any big difference between winter and summer makeup in terms of making yourself look good?
I do think there is. In winter months, chuck on a really deep, sexy, velvety red lipstick, and you can, she says, kind of shimmying, like that can have the same kind of empowering feeling as popping on, you know, a beautiful pink gloss or pink cheek of a beautiful summer's day.
What appeals to you about being online? You do a lot now across platforms online, and you already had a really full career. You're already plenty busy. What about, I want to say, educating and also being on 10 years younger in 10 days and, you know, programs? Is it just that you reach more people, or is there something you like about the autonomy of online?
Oh, interesting question. I do love the autonomy of being online. I love that I can, think tutorials in my head and then just film them, do them and put them out there. And I think I always took the standpoint with, say, like my Instagram platform, that it was, you know, predominantly makeup based, your beauty based, but that, you know, I wanted to do, you know, realistic beauty. And I remember, if you scroll back far enough to when I very first started Instagram, I didn't know what I was doing, but I did a couple of really awful hyperlapse makeups. Like, they are terrible. The makeup's not terrible, but the videos themselves are terrible because they're not edited, they're far too fast. But I had this idea that I was like, right, what I want to do is I want to do a speedy makeup, and then I want to do a flat lay of the products I used so people can see what is realistic. So with these products, this is a realistic makeup look that can be achieved. And everyone's doing them, but I started doing kind of before and after pictures as a, like, here's a flat lay of the products I used, here's a pore and up, this is what I looked like before, and this is how my face has changed using the products in the aforementioned picture, whether it was before or after. And I think that was when, I can't remember, it was one Christmas, and maybe it was Stylist, but they put me, or Glamour, I can't remember, but they put me in an article being like, makeup artists to watch online, and why. And they'd said, like, we love Hannah's, like, authentic before and afters. It's super realistic, because I was so irritated with you know, either just super, super heavy makeup pictures or pictures that were like ridiculously altered. Now, remember, I'm talking about before things like Facetune, or did Facetune exist from the beginning? I just remember people using really bizarre apps to do really bizarre, awful Photoshop and stuff, and just thinking, why are you posting that picture? It looks nothing like you.
I have one along these lines. Maybe you can tell me if this is what you think. I can't stand it when people don't look human anymore. Like, I love it when you see the... because that's the thing about makeup, right? It makes you look... I mean, it's so hackneyed, but it makes you look your best self, as it were. But you still look human. What I can't stand, whether it's through surgery or makeup, is when people start to not look like a human being anymore. So I think that when people put those photos on, whether it's through filters or face tuning apps or whatever it might be, I just don't like it. I don't like it. There's something about it that makes me think, I don't like looking at this. It doesn't feel like it's actually makeup at all. It just feels a bit depressing, really, basically.
But I also think it's really misleading and confusing. So,
yes.
Like, I suppose the way I've worked it out in my brain, I'm like, if it's on a story... and it's not a work-related thing, do whatever you want, sweetheart. Chuck a filter on it. Do whatever you want. But if you're trying to show a makeup look or a makeup technique, then in that space, or in my opinion, a filter is unforgivable. It's false advertising.
It's also way less helpful as well during the aging process, because I think if you're starting to do that and people at 50 are kind of thinking, well, what can I do in my unadulterated face? It's very uncomfortable to only see people who've gotten rid of everything or every sign of aging, because not everyone will have done that.
I just hope there's a movement where, you know, especially people in the industry who people look up to, like, I think we have more of a responsibility than everyone to not be misleading. I get it. There are apps and filters that are so flattering. Like, go ahead. Like, live your best life. Do it on your stories where it's, you know, been and gone in a minute. But if it's something you're putting on your main grid that you are professing to be something...
I love the face you're pulling now. You can't see the face Hannah's pulling. It was like a wrinkled nose and a very uncomfortable lip.
I was so unsure about saying that, but...
No, I'm with you. And I think that's a really important point of integrity as well as a makeup artist. Okay, we don't have much longer. I'm going to quickly ask you one more question before we move on to the three questions that I ask all my guests. So, okay, you've got fingers in so many pies and you have this, you know, lovely relationship with your husband that I imagine you still want to have date nights and nurture. So I'm wondering, where you have 5, 10 minutes, half an hour even, what you do that makes you feel good and how you look after yourself, the body, the mind, the spirit. What is it that you do for yourself?
It's a challenging question. And actually, I've seen quite a few kind of quotes and memes recently about, like, not wearing your busyness as a badge of honor, because it's actually nothing to be proud of. And I'm happier when I'm busy, actually. I enjoy being busy. However, there's a fine line between enjoying being busy and just having a full life and then a complete overwhelm. And I teeter. Like, it's, what am I trying to say? It's a very fine line between happily being busy and juggling and feeling like you're kind of winning to then feeling completely and utterly overwhelmed, yes, kind of a bit drowning in stuff. My husband and I have talked a lot about, you know, in the future, what can I do with my career to kind of streamline slightly? Because to your point, I do have my finger in a lot of pies and I love my career for that, because I can do so many different things and I don't quite know how I'd streamline it, but it's something that we're talking about, because I can't maintain necessarily the pace that I've been working in recent years.
Does he work full time?
Actually, he works 4 days now. He doesn't work on a Friday, so he is kind of icy children and everything on a Friday. So yeah, I don't know what that looks like. Thankfully Simon is like, he's very supportive and very capable. So, you know, it's not that we split the childcare because we're both parents, but he's perfectly capable of doing, mm-hmm. you know, lots of childcare.
Right. To finish, I'm going to ask you three questions I ask all my guests. So the first one, what to your mind's been your greatest triumph, career or personal?
So many things I'd want to say, but it's got to be my children.
One piece of advice you would give your younger self, which younger self would you return to as well?
I'd love to return to the younger self who was the like fearless gymnast, cross country running, full of, I didn't know what it meant to feel unfit because I'd never felt it. I'd also say to her, it's going to be all right. You'll find your way. It's going to be absolutely fine.
Do you know what's interesting? So many people say that as their bit of advice to themselves. I think it's kind of really sad that we all sit there worrying and actually older version of ourselves is always like, it'll be fine. Like, it'll be fine. Okay, name three people, dead or alive, who you'd like to have dinner with and why. Who you'd have at a dinner party?
Elizabeth Taylor.
For her looks?
For her looks, so I could try on the Taylor Berta diamond and just so we could talk Hollywood because it just fascinates me. Britney Spears, because she was like, she's long been like my style icon.
Style? Clothes icon?
Yes!
Even now?
No!
Okay. That sounded really bitchy. Sorry, I didn't mean to say that like that. But just, you know, I feel like her style now is not quite...
No, she's responsible for kind of inappropriately low-cut jeans and boob tubes and all the rest of it and like doing 2,000 sit-ups a day because I just wanted to look like her. Yeah. And then I'm torn because part of me's like... You know, I remember Lise Potter Dixon saying that Jennifer Lawrence would be a brilliant dinner party guest. And I thought, yes, she's hilarious. But then I always find, what's his name? Tom. He's always a brilliant guest on, whether it's Jonathan Ross or Graham Norton.
Who? Tom who?
Hanks.
Tom Hanks. Yeah. Oh, yeah, yeah. I'm with you on Tom Hanks. Yeah. Tom Hanks. Also... nice man.
Yeah.
Like, really decent man. Yeah, that's a good list. Well, thank you so much, Hannah, for coming on.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.